Okay, as you all know, this is the last lecture this quarter, and what I want to do today is sit back and have you sit back and think about what you want to take away from a course like this. And what's the point of it? It's not just learning about a lot of these different historical episodes and making different points about, you know, the July crisis or America's road to war in 1941 or the Cold War, whatever. You want to get some insight into these basic issues, these issues of war and peace, these issues about how does international politics work? You know, is there anything of a general nature that we could say about policy, about how policy should be conducted? What do you want to take away from the course? I mean, this is a question for you to figure out for yourself. It's not like I'm going to provide you with answers on a silver platter that you're just expected to accept. You recall in the very beginning of the class, in the syllabus, I had a section about all these fundamental issues that we were going to deal with in this class. There was a vehicle for grappling with some of the most basic issues of international relations theory. Can you have war even if no one really wants it? Is war always the result of aggression, or can people slip into an armed conflict more or less by accident? What effect do nuclear weapons have on international politics? Are they a source of stability? Or did the emergence of a stable peace during the Cold War period have relatively little to do with nuclear weapons? And what does the story we're exploring tell us about the effect of different political systems? Do democracies, for example, pursue a particular kind of policy? And if so, is that policy a source of peace or of instability? Right? You know, those are big issues. Those are really important issues. And they're not just issues of historical importance. The way you answer them will determine how you think about international politics more generally. It will shape the sort of framework they use for thinking about these questions of foreign policy today and in the future. Okay. So one of the things I'd really like you to do, although of course you're not going to be examined on this, but if you want to get something out of this class, you know, go back, look at those questions, and say, what have I learned? How has my thinking changed over time? What was it when I started taking this class, or before I took this class 10 weeks ago? How is it different now on those big issues, those kind of core issues? All right. So as I say, the goal of the class is to give you the tools you need to make up your mind for yourself about those fundamental questions, right? How to read a text, how to think critically. And, you know, I've talked with you a lot of you about the midterm exam, and a number of you kind of felt you messed up in the midterm exam, or what went wrong. These are skills that are very hard to develop. It's not just like me telling you how to do it and, you know, well, it's obvious, you'll just do it. You've been programmed, you know, through years and years of, high school and before high school, grade school, into being, you're told that you should believe the things that you read, you should believe the things that professors tell you in class. As I say, you just look at the structure of the class today. Here I am spouting out, there you are, you know, like it's supposed to be like sponges taking down what I say. That's not real education. Right? And the goal of a class like this is to kind of help you break that habit. You know, move away from a kind of a passive approach to learning to a much more active approach, right? You have the right to look at a text and say, is this argument compelling? Is there any, you know, what is this author trying to convince me of? Should I believe it? There's a method. You identify the thesis, and then you look at how the author goes about convincing you that basic argument is accurate in terms both of evidence and in terms of logic. So as I say, these are things that you're going to have to decide for yourself. All right? If you want to get something real out of the course. All I can do today is to tell you in a more personal way about how my own thinking has changed in the 50 plus years ever since I started, I have to say, becoming obsessed with these sorts of issues. I was this is during my freshman year at Berkeley. I took a class with Raymond Sontag in the spring of 1963, and it just totally changed my life. How has my own thinking changed? I came in to college with a set of beliefs about how international politics works, you know, just absorbed from the larger culture. How do you explain a great war? Essentially moral terms. You know, there were peace-loving countries and there were aggressors. You know, look at World War II. You know, look at the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, you remember that very last page in the Taylor book about, you know, just alludes in passing to, you know, America was a country that asked only to be left alone. We kind of believe that. We were minding our own business, nice, peaceful country, absorbed with our own internal affairs. And then out of the blue, the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. And I was like, well, you know, a war is caused by aggression. Who could be more aggressive than Hitler? Who could be more evil than Hitler? You know, it's moral theory of war. And then the Cold War, you know, kind of growing up in the Cold War period, again, black and white. America, the democracies, these are the good guys. Soviets are evil. They're aggressors. They're the bad guys. Simple as that. These ideological differences. They have this revolutionary ideology. They want to impose their control on as much of the world as they can. You know, the only thing that's keeping them back are these American threats to start a general nuclear war. It's deterrence. Deterrence is the be-all and end-all of strategy. Right? Those were the views I started out with. And now, as I hope you all know by the end of this course, I don't look at things that way at all. It's not that moral issues count for nothing. It's not that the concept of aggression is inherently meaningless. It's that the story is a whole lot more complex than that. And that political factors, as opposed to moral factors, political factors having to do with power realities, you know, impersonal forces, forces that, you know, you can't make hard and fast moral judgments about. These things count for a whole lot more than I had realized. You know? And looking at the history, it's not just a bunch of events strung together over time. And then finally, there's one crisis where the aggressor isn't deterred, and then you get a war. You know, instead, you know, I've come to look at wars and international politics in general as wars as the climax of a process, essentially a political process, you know, unfolding over time, about which moral judgments are often deeply problematic, and with a certain logic to it, not just random events, but there's a logic that leads from this event to that event to that event. And grasping what that logic is, you know, why the story has a kind of a plot, well, that's what gives you insight into how international politics works. I say political as opposed to moral. I mean that in three senses. Political in the sense that that you can't make these hard and fast moral judgments. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like, who's right and who's wrong? Are the Soviets wrong to be concerned about a possible resurgence of German power in the early Cold War period? It's hard to say that. Are the Americans wrong to say that Soviet pressures have to be resisted? You know, again, you can see things through the eyes of people on both sides. 1914, are the Austrians wrong to be concerned about the threat that Serbia posed? Are the Entente powers wrong to feel that there should be limits in terms of how far the Central Powers should be able to go in crushing the independence of Serbia? Again, you know, it's like, well, you can see things through the Austrian point of view, the German point of view, the Russian point of view, French point of view, whatever. Right? Political as opposed to moral. These moral judgments are often not nearly as clear-cut as you think. You know, political in the sense of the importance of power realities in shaping the course of events. Over and over again, we've seen this. This is the thread that provides meaning to the story. This is the key to the logic, the power political logic. Now, that's a powerful argument, realist argument. And you could see how you could take it to extremes. I mean, that was the problem with the Taylor book. It's basically a powerful concept, but you push it to these extremes to the point where it becomes ridiculous. It doesn't mean that there's nothing to it. The whole trick is to figure out how to strike a balance between, you know, a structure and intent, between political factors and power factors and state groups. And also, there's another sense in which I'm using this term, apolitical process. And that's political as opposed to military. There are all these views that emphasize the importance of military factors in bringing on a war. And they're shared throughout the political spectrum. You know, it's like on the right, there's this whole notion that the key thing in determining whether you have war and peace is how credible your deterrent is. Everything is focused on the calculations of a would-be aggressor at the peak of a crisis as he faces his moment of truth, right? Our emphasis should be on making sure that our deterrent threat is as credible as possible. We have to build as strong a nuclear force or whatever as we can, right? Military theory, right? If you have a war, it's because militarily we're weak, right? That whole notion. On the left, you have this whole idea that arms control is of fundamental importance. Why do they think arms control is of fundamental importance? Because they see military factors as the central taproot of war. The stability of the nuclear balance. This is the thing that we really have to worry about. Right. The arms race. This friend of mine, Steve Shuker, he refers to the whole theory that the arms race is the fundamental cause of international conflict as the phlogiston theory of international politics. The problem with those notions is that they don't take into account the fact that political factors are of fundamental importance. They don't view war as the climax of a process. And with the implication about policy, there are important implications here about policy. We shouldn't focus simply on crises and making sure our deterrent is as strong as possible, or that the military structure that's in place at the time is as stable as possible. Instead, we should look at the political process that can follow over years, in fact, over decades, that culminates in a war. And we should try and do what we can to make sure that that political process runs its course in a relatively peaceful way. So the focus should be not on the peak of the crisis, but on ordinary, normal international politics. And the aim of policy is to use both carrots and sticks, incentives and disincentives, to influence the political behavior of your adversary. Okay? A wholly different approach to how you think about policy. Okay. Now, those are views that didn't occur to me overnight as soon as I took that first course. They evolved over a period of years. How did they evolve? You know, by me being exposed to international relations theory. You know, was it the case that I read Hans Morgenthau's Politics Among Nations or whatever, and convinced me, oh yeah, this is the way things should be understood. You know, now it wasn't this, that kind of top-down approach where you grapple with these issues at a high level of abstraction, you grapple with these theoretical issues, and then after you reach your conclusions by thinking it through at that level, then that informs the way you understand things at the more concrete level. That's not the way things work. It's not a top-down process, it's a bottom-up process. You start by trying to make sense of various historical episodes. And as you do that, almost automatically, without you even being aware of how it's happening, a certain fundamental view takes shape. You know, it's the conceptual framework that's automatically hammered out as you grapple with these, you know, important historical problems. How is the First World War to be understood? The Second World War. Second World War both in Europe and in Asia. The Cold War. Okay? And you explore those historical issues not by just going into the mass of primary sources that deal with them and trying to make up your mind for yourself. I mean, for one thing, no one ever has the time to read everything. You make up your mind by reacting to the claims that other people make. Right? There's always a literature on these things. There are always standard interpretations. And you notice that different interpretations have a certain theoretical resonance. Some interpretations have a realist flavor. Other interpretations have a more liberal flavor, and so on. Being sensitive to that means that whatever conclusions you reach about the substantive historical issue you're concerned with, those conclusions will automatically have theoretical implications. Right? So you react to claims. Using this kind of a basic method that I've put so much emphasis on in this class. You identify the argument, you analyze the argument. How good is it in terms of the evidence supporting it? How powerful is it in terms of its internal logic? Okay? And, in my own life, over and over again, I've done work that led me to some important conclusions about specific historical episodes, and through that helped me hammer out a conceptual framework that I used to think about international politics. And we've gone through a lot of this stuff in this course. The whole paper about 1914 and the coming of the First World War during the July crisis. You can see the way that article was set up. I'm reacting to these claims that I found all around me when I started interacting with political scientists. I'm a historian by training, and I would have been perfectly happy to spend the rest of my life in a history department doing historical work, except for the fact that the historical profession changed very dramatically in the course of my career, and I felt myself increasingly marginalized within my own profession. And these political scientists were nice enough to take me in. I felt practically like a refugee from Nazi Germany who had come to the United States in the 1930s. They take you in, and you feel you have to kind of give back. So I saw all these arguments about inadvertent war, saying, "Oh yeah, nuclear age. No one wants nuclear war, but nevertheless, there's a real risk of nuclear war. We have to be concerned about it. Well, how can there be a risk of nuclear war if no one wants it? It's because it could happen anyway because of the workings of the military system. You don't need a real political basis for conflict. It's these forces welling up from within the military sphere that can bring on a war that no one wants, especially this incentive to go first, to get in the first blow. Okay? Very important body of thought in international relations theory in the late 50s and early 60s especially. And he said, well, what's the basis for this? It's kind of interesting as a theoretical argument, but isn't it just kind of a castle in the air? You know, does it have a strong empirical base? I said, well, you look at what these people say, and over again, he's like, the argument is, oh, this may sound a little crazy, that a war can come because of these military forces, and you don't need a real political conflict, but it happened once before. There's this one really big case in which it happened before, namely, the coming of the First World War in 1914. That was caused by these forces welling up from within the military sphere. You know, it's like a famous book by Barbara Tuchman called The Guns of August. She made big bestseller. She made this kind of argument. It's like, well, is there anything to that argument? It's a very, very powerful argument. It supports a theory that was the conceptual basis of arms control. Arms control playing a very important role in American policy during the 60s and 70s. So, well, let's unpack it. Why do they think this military stuff led to a war? Well, it turns out there are these three arguments. It's because the war plans are so rigid. Well, why should that lead to a war? You know, would if the plans had been more flexible, if there had been more options, would a war have been averted? Well, why? And so we start unpacking it, and you start thinking about it. Well, what evidence do they give? Oh, well, there's this famous story about Kaiser thought that the British would stay out of the war if the Germans fought the war in the East, and he tried to change the war plan, and he was told it couldn't be done, and he had no answer for this and gave way, and this shows how these rigid war plans, you know, have these kind of terrible effects and bring on a war that doesn't make sense at all. All right? That's the claim. Turns out that the claim is based on a total misreading of that story. It wasn't the Kaiser who had to give way, it was the military leadership that gave way. You know, General von Moltke says, I went home and cried tears of despair. I thought my heart would break. Now it's clear he was the one who was defeated. It's like, that's how you do it. And setting up the problem in such a way that these kind of big issues about how important are military factors in bringing on a war are made to turn on important historical interpretations, that's how war came in July 1914, and those interpretations about 1914 rest on these arguments, rigidity of war plans, which in turn rest on the story about the Kaiser being unable to change the plan. So then when you see what the truth is about that story, automatically it's going to spill back up and affect the way you think about these fundamental issues. Okay. If the military stuff isn't important, then how is the coming of the First World War to be understood? Well, in political terms, political conflict. A conflict that has something to do with the structure of power. Okay. What's going on with this whole Serbian thing? Well, the Serbs can do this because they're backed by Russia. And Russia is backed by France. And France is backed by Britain. And how did that happen? You know, why was it that the Russians were able to pursue an offensive policy in the Balkans, a policy which was recognized even by their ally, French, as extremely dangerous? Well, it had to do with the deterioration of relations between Germany and the Western powers and the two Moroccan crises. You know, tensions increase between Germany and the West, Russia, as the third party in the equation, is bound to see its position improved. You see this exactly the same phenomenon on the eve of the Second World War, you know, as Germany moves toward conflict with Britain and France, Russia is in the driver's seat. Right? Nazi-Soviet pact. I mean, that's what I mean by the logic. The power, there's a power political logic. These things don't happen at random. Okay. Second example is the Cannon article. I remember just being blown away by that Cannon article. It was a totally different take on American policy during the Wilson period. You know, here in high school, we're all led to believe, it's probably still the case, that Wilson is this great hero, he's this prophet, he stands up for this kind of the core moral values of our country. He wants to spread democracy. He's in favor of, justice and peace and international organizations, so all the good stuff. And then Cannon's saying, yeah, that's who Wilson was. But in fact, that's what messed everything up. He should have been thinking in amoral power political terms. He should have been aiming at creating a stable structure of power, and not so much with punishing the Germans. You know, it's like, see, implicitly, you have to do a kind of a thought experiment, a counterfactual thought experiment. Suppose the United States pursued the kind of policy that Kennan said we should have pursued. A realist policy, a policy based on power considerations. How would things have turned out? If you come to the conclusion, as I personally did, that things would have turned out a whole lot better than they did. In fact, given what happened, it's hard to imagine how anything could have turned out worse. If you reach that conclusion, well, that's powerful evidence in support of the basic Kennan approach to these things. Maybe realism is the way to go. Maybe all these liberal notions, they seem so good, in fact, have a very destructive effect on international politics. You see, you understand why this is so powerful? Because it runs so deeply against what you had previously believed. Right? If these people are just telling you stuff you already know, there's no value. You learn from being able to say to yourself, gee, I was wrong. I had thought that this was the case, but it turns out that there's an entirely different way of looking at things. It's actually better. When I was in graduate school, I did my dissertation on European politics, international politics in the post-World War I period. The period of the Treaty of Versailles, Paris Peace Conference, the period going through the Ruhr occupation in 1923. And again, this is one of these things where it's like saying, who's right and who's wrong? You can understand why the French behaved as they did, especially given their power political position. On the other hand, you can understand why the Germans would resist. Who am I to sin in judgment on one side or the other? It makes much more sense to put these issues of judgment aside and just look at the whole question dispassionately and objectively. How do things work? How does the process run its course? Right? And you can do that. The same sort of point about the late 20s and Stresemann and whole issue of the distinction between the 20s and the 30s. Once again, we had been led to believe that the Locarno period and late 20s period, when it looked like peace was being put on a stable basis, and if it hadn't been for the Great Depression, which brought Hitler to power in Germany, everything would have been okay. Stresemann was a good European. He was willing to reach an accommodation with the West and so on. And then it turns out, some very good scholars have worked on that issue, and they showed that view was essentially a myth, that Stresemann was a nationalist, that he wanted to build up German power, that the fundamental political problem had not been resolved, had been papered over temporarily for tactical purposes on the part of the Germans. What's like kind of the key evidence there of continuity between the 20s and the 30s, a greater degree of continuity than we had been led to believe, and hence a greater importance to be ascribed to structural factors? Well, it's the fact that the French had decided to build the Maginot Line in 1929, before the Depression even struck, well before Hitler came to power. It's like they knew that the German problem had not been solved. They knew that there was a new threat, and they were already deciding that they had to invest huge resources in preparing to defend themselves against this resurgent Germany, which they viewed as posing a threat. Very important, because it throws light on this whole issue of, you know, what's of fundamental importance in international politics? These structural things, or kind of, you know, who happens to be in charge of policy, the particular character of the statesman. It shows that structure is more important than you think, that there's more to the realist theory than you would think. See, that's what a theory is. The theory is kind of making a meta claim. The theory is basically saying, this stuff is more important than a lot of people say. The realist theory is power politics, power political considerations, structure of power, changes in the structure of power. All those things are of fundamental importance in shaping the way international politics runs its course. That's the realist claim. This stuff counts for more than a lot of people think. And so when you see your prior views having to be changed in the face of the evidence in a way that's in line with what that theory suggests, well, that's powerful evidence in support of the theory. What's the goal of a theory like that? To provide you with answers? No. This is a very important point. A lot of people think otherwise. They think that the aim of work in political science is theory building. The theories that are to be constructed as a kind of end in themselves because they explain how things work. In fact, that's not why, to my mind, a theory is of value. It's of value not because it provides answers, but because it allows you to bring questions into focus. It generates puzzles that you wouldn't ordinarily see as puzzles. And the whole story of the run-up to America's involvement in the Second World War, good case in point, both in Europe and in Asia. It's like, there's a puzzle there when you look at Japanese policy. Like, everyone said, Pearl Harbor, how do you understand that? All these Japanese, they're war-crazed militarists, they're lunatics, totally irrational. It's like, is it irrational? How do you explain Japanese policy if American policy was so passive? Here they are, their hands full, fighting this unwinnable war on the Asian mainland in China. And having their hands full with that, they're going to go out of their way and gratuitously attack the strongest country in the world by far in terms of its mobilizable war potential, a country that they know is unbeatable and unconquerable. It's like, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Similarly, Hitler going to war with the United States, hands full in Russia. You know, why would he declare war in the United States? These are war-crazed lunatics. End of the story. It's like, does it make sense? If you're a realist, if you kind of have learned to think that power considerations are of fundamental importance in determining sorts of policies that are pursued, it's like none of this makes sense. You know, it's like, why would the Japanese do such a thing? Well, see, that's what the theory does. It generates questions like that. This is a loose thread in the whole fabric of the received interpretation. You know, you start pulling on it, and the fabric begins to unravel. It's like, was America as passive as people say? Oh, no, it wasn't. Why were we not passive? Because we were scared to death of what it would mean if Hitler was allowed to conquer all of Europe up to the Urals and harness the vast war-making resources of all of continental Europe to his war-making machine. Then that would pose a very serious threat to American security. You know, a straight power political argument. And therefore, We can't just sit on our hands. We can't pursue a purely defensive policy. We can't just wait until the problem becomes really big and unmanageable before we do anything. We have to kind of pursue a more active policy. President Roosevelt says this openly in his radio addresses to the country, especially in late 1941, well before Pearl Harbor. We're fighting an undeclared naval war in the Atlantic. Right? We're pursuing a very tough line vis-a-vis the Japanese in the Pacific with the oil and well, why? Huh? You see, that's the function of the theory. See, it brings the puzzles into focus. Cold War, another big case. Huh? Cold War is puzzling. You wouldn't realize that it's puzzling if you just looked at it through the, you know, normal lenses of, well, they're communists, we're a liberal democratic power. Obviously, there's going to be this conflict. Well, why should that be? Where's the political difference? Yeah, sure, they would want to, ideally, they'd want to see communist regimes throughout all of Europe, probably throughout the entire world. We'd like democratic regimes in all of Eastern Europe. But neither side is going to push those goals to the point where there's a serious risk of a third world war. It's vastly preferable. The status quo for both sides, vastly preferable to a war that was designed to achieve their ideological objectives. Ideology is necessarily of limited importance. It's necessarily conditioned by those power realities. Right? Well, if that's the case, where's the problem? See, this is that whole question is generated by a theoretical perspective. Where's the problem? You know, they're willing to accept the division of Europe, much, you know, to respect American power in Western Europe. We're willing to respect the division of Europe, Soviet-dominated Eastern Europe. For us, that's vastly preferable to a war. For them, the situation is vastly preferable to a war. So why do you have the Cold War? See, that's a puzzle. How do you go about answering that? You're following the train of an argument. You know, you're trying to unravel this puzzle. Answer the puzzle. One big exception to this general rule about how the two sides could get along. That general rule, they call the shots on their side of the line of demarcation. We control things on our side. Okay? One big exception. They can't give us a totally free hand to do what we want in Western Germany, because they're concerned about West Germany getting too much power. And yet we, for our part, have to respond to Soviet pressures by building up Western Germany, by supporting it, underwriting its policies to a certain extent in order to secure its adhesion to the West. Our goals are defensive. Their goals are defensive. Right? But still, the situation is such that a conflict is generated. With the implication that if there's to be a stable system, if there's to be a settlement, that core issue has to be resolved. So we look. See, the whole thought process serves to focus our attention on what the core issue is, this whole question of German power. In the nuclear age, that means the question of German nuclear capability has to be of central importance. You know, at least that's what the theory would lead us to think. Lo and behold, looking at the evidence, you know, from that perspective, you find it supports that interpretation. It allows you to develop an entire theory of the Cold War, what was driving it, and why the threat receded, why something like a settlement kind of came into being around 1963. All right? I mean, theory is powerful. I mean, even when you look at the outbreak of the war in Europe in 1939, traditional view, Nazi aggression, pure and simple. How do you explain the Second World War? One word answer, Hitler. Right? And it turns out Hitler didn't want the war that broke out in 1939. You remember that story I told about how when he received news of the British declaration of war, he turns to his foreign minister, Ribbentrop, and says in German, "Was nun?" You know, what do we do now? You've been trying very hard to avoid the war. That's the meaning of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. You know, so the British were counting on Russian assistance to be able to resist Germany on the Polish issue. Now Russia is going to be an ally of Germany. Russia's bought off. The British will see their position is hopeless. They'll avoid the war. They'll give way. Right? Didn't set out to provoke the war, but in the process of trying to deter the West, he got himself deeper and deeper into the problem, more and more deeply involved, very hard to resist, very hard to back off. Same point about the West. Didn't set out to have a war, pessimistic about whether the conflict could be resolved. But as each side gets more deeply involved in the political dispute, it's harder and harder to kind of back off. Key to understanding 1939. You know, it's very different from the view that you'd grown up with.
Okay.
There's a whole approach, like I was talking about the Cold War, whole approach. It doesn't focus on these issues of blame. Right? You could study the history pushing these questions of blame to the side. Focus on structure. How could you have a stable peace? How? Well, you could. If you're an American, you couldn't contemplate a system where the Soviets were allowed to take over all of Europe. Same reason we opposed the Nazis in 1941, we're going to oppose the Soviets in the Cold War period. We'd accept their control of Eastern Europe, but if they took over all of Western Europe, which after all is far more important in terms of its war-making resources, that would pose such a serious threat to American security that it had to be prevented. Well, how are you going to prevent it? More than one way, in theory. Eisenhower had this view that it shouldn't be America's job to defend Western Europe. These Europeans, if they could only come together, were strong enough to develop the sort of forces they needed to kind of keep the Soviets at bay. Right? He wanted America to pull out. That implied that the Europeans had to be able to defend themselves. That implied in particular that the Germans had to be able to defend themselves. And the only way you could defend yourself against a strong nuclear power like the Soviet Union is by being a nuclear power yourself. No way you could stand up without nuclear forces of your own. Right? And we saw how that policy, the Eisenhower nuclear sharing policy, led directly to the Berlin crisis, the Berlin / Cuban crisis of 1958 to 62, climactic episode of the Cold War, Cuban Missile Crisis, climax of this great Berlin crisis. We, you know, try to understand the dynamics of that crisis. What conclusion was to be drawn from the fact that the Eisenhower policy led directly to this? Well, it's an important one. Conclusions is important. You know, it's like good intentions aren't enough. It's like, how could you quarrel with Eisenhower's intentions? Didn't like it, the whole idea of Imperial America. Felt other countries should stand on their own 2 feet. And yet you can see how that policy led directly to this very sharp crisis. Conclusion, no purely European solution to the European security problem. The Americans got to stay in. Conclusion drawn by Kennedy. Dramatic change in American policy from Eisenhower and Kennedy opens up the possibility of a settlement. But for a variety of reasons, the very fact that concessions had to be made, in a sense, and the American policy had to be changed for what it had previously been, was taken as a sign of weakness. And instead of leading to a quick settlement, as Kennedy had hoped in 1961, Soviets toughened their position, became intransigent. Kennedy reaches the conclusion that a showdown is inevitable and comes to the conclusion that if there's going to be a showdown, let's have it sooner rather than later because we still have a nuclear edge, but in a matter of months, we're going to lose it. Okay? Very important because it shows the importance of the shifting nuclear balance in shaping the course of international policy. politics.
Okay.
So the crisis runs its course. It's the key to understanding the Cuban Missile Crisis, not a separate episode, not something that just happens, you know, a cut off from the main central thrust of East-West relations, which focused on Europe and on the German question and on the Berlin Crisis. The Cuban business is very intimately related with what's going on in Europe. The missile crisis, climax of this whole confrontation, was important because it revealed information. Here again, you can see how the perspective of international relations theory is helpful in understanding things. The emphasis on information. Crisis reveals information. It reveals that the Americans were tough and that the Soviets were bluffing. And it paves the way for a de facto, tacit, set of understandings that take shape in 1963, watershed date in the Cold War, the threat of a general nuclear holocaust, which people took quite seriously up through 1962, you know, recedes. No one was really that much worried about it from 1963 on. The temptation is to say, those understandings provided the basis for stable international order. Well, almost, not quite. There's this basic flaw in the system. The basic flaw is, in an era of nuclear parity, even the American presence might not be enough to defend Western Europe. There's a fundamental structural flaw. And the question is, why don't the Soviets take advantage of it? It influences Western policy, influences German policy. The Soviets don't seem to want to take advantage of it. And there again, since maybe it's a puzzle from a standpoint of realist theory. But it forces you to kind of look inside the black box and analyze Soviet policy, the Soviet economic problem, as I say, key to that whole story. Anyway. That's the way a conceptual framework gets hammered out. Grappling with these kind of specific issues and looking at all these different episodes and trying to say, what's important here? How does it bear on these fundamental questions that international relations theorists are interested in? At least that's the way it worked for me. That's how I developed my own sense for how international politics works, about, the sorts of policies that should be pursued in a general level. All I can say is that I hope that you, in taking this course, have learned something of that sort from it, that there's something of a general nature that you're taking away from all the work you did this quarter. So on that note, let me thank you for all of the effort that you've put in this quarter, and also wish you good luck on the final exam on Friday. So I'll see you on Friday. Okay, thank you.